when you look at the Gen X, what was starting with them, boomers started with the music of a Christian contemporary music, but Gen X started to make it kind of an art form. And what I meant by that is they started looking at it as marketing. And so even as a youth pastor, what I would get is this. I would get these lists, and it would say something like this. If you're a youth group kid, you're a young person, like the Police. And I'm not talking about 5-0 on 47 here. There's a band with a guy named Sting, who's the lead singer, actually. His name is Gordon Sumner, but we won't go there. If they like the Police, then they would like this group. If they like Nirvana, then they would like this group. And so you had Christian rock, you had Christian rap, you had Christian alternative, you had Christian grunge, and that bugged the church. That's another thing that bugged the church. And what was happening was I would take kids in my youth group because I believed in Christian contemporary music. And so, for example, I think I told you this story before, I took them to see Rich Mullins. And, Lincoln Christian College. And he came out with bare feet. And he did his concert. Oh, well, hold on. And it was great. Rich Mullins was, like, really good. Okay. We go home, God even did some work in the lives of my young people, where there were decisions being made, some great things were happening. No lie. By Wednesday, there was a meeting that I had to go to. Somebody wasn't happy that he didn't have shoes on during the concert. And so they pulled me into the big pastor's office. Okay, that's when I was a little pastor, just a youth pastor. And so they pulled me in the office, and this family start sharing these concerns, these things. Have you ever heard Rich Mullins? Have you ever heard his heart? It's amazing. And, I can't believe we're having this conversation right now. Okay. And then ultimately I had to say that because that's me. But then ultimately we go, and I didn't apologize, but I was just trying to get across. Come on, seriously? But this is what was going on regularly. How could they be Christians if they do this? And it's all looks. And what always concerned me is Mormons looked like Christians. They looked the part. They had the haircut. They wore the suit. They all looked that look. So what? And I always would go, what does a Christian look like? And that's, I think, what was going on with Gen X. I think Gen X was responding to a culture that was, or to a church culture that was tired of dealing with some of this stuff. So if we could imagine for a moment what this world looked like for Generation X. Remember, we've had GI, Silent, Baby Boomer, and now Gen X. I hope you grab notes. There's some notes there, please, because this is gonna really rock your world with some of these things. But I want to kind of expose you to some of the things. Remember, there's turning points for different generations. One of the turning points, obviously, for GI was World War II, Pearl Harbor, and all of those things. Silent, much of it was things like Brown versus Board of Education or rock and roll. For boomers, a huge one was the assassination of JFK. For Gen X, one of the biggest deals for them was the Challenger explosion. You can talk to a Gen X kid, they remember where they were when they saw that. And I remember their teacher pulling in, back then they didn't have TVs in every room, you had to have an AV guy bring it in, you know, and they set it up, and they're watching this thing because it was exciting, and that thing explodes in front of all their classes, and now they've got to explain something to them. There's something else that came into being. This is the MTV when it first happened. First day on MTV.
Seven, six, five, four. We've gone from man to the start. We have.
Yeah.
This is it. Rapid MTV Music Television, the world's first 24-hour stereo video music channel. Just moments ago, all of the DJs and the crew here at MTV collectively hit our executive producer, Sue Steinberg, over the head with a bottle of champagne, and behold, a new concept is born. The best of TV combined with the best of radio. Now, starting right now, you'll never look at music the same way again. We'll be right back to introduce the other VJs and the other folks who are going to be with us on MTV.
I'm Alan Hunter. I'll be with you right after Mark. We'll be covering the latest in music news coast to coast here on MTV Music Television.
I'm Martha Quinn. The music will continue right back on MTV Music Television, the newest component of your stereo system.
Well, all right, I'm J.J. Jackson, and I'll be sitting in with the latest video music performances the way they were meant to be. That's in stereo on MTV Music Television. You'll never get the music the same way.
So, those of you that are Gen Xers, this was a whole new thing for you. You were like, wow. And what was going on is pitching these things to the executives at these different places, like Ted Turner approached people and said, hey, I'm thinking about this idea. 24-hour nonstop news. I think, and many of them laughed at it. Like, nobody's going to watch that. No, they'll wait till 5 o'clock. They'll wait till 10 o'clock. And so that is what was going on. Movies that came out of that time. There was, people were being defined in different ways. This is from a movie called The Breakfast Club. It is the last. What happened to Breakfast Club is it actually is a detention. What happened is they're stuck in detention, and they're actually asked to write an essay at the end of it and describe who they are. So listen to their essay that they did together.
Dear Mr. Burns, we accept the fact that we had sacrificed the whole Saturday in detention for whatever it was we did wrong. But we think you're crazy to make us write an essay and hear who you think we are. You see us as a box here. In the simplest terms, with the most convenient definition. But what we found out is that each one of us is a brain, then an athlete,
and a basket case, a princess,
and a crown. Does that answer your question? Sincerely yours, The Breakfast Club.
So if you listen to that, they're saying something that I think is pretty powerful. You now can't buttonhole us. You now cannot pigeonhole us. And so we are every aspect of that. And what I loved about Gen X was, because I remember, I'm on the line, okay? There were people were easily defined, and people liked it that way. That person's a greaser, that person's a brain, that person's a job, that person. And what they said is, and I remember talking to many of these guys even, as millennials, as we started, who do you hang with? And they would be like, you know what, we actually hang with everybody. And there's a beauty to the millennial mind, especially in the fact that certain things are so acceptable now. Some things aren't good, but some things, like right now, with a millennial switching to that for a second, you can be a nerd, and that's kind of cool. Back when I was a kid, if you were a nerd, you got beat up. That's just part of the deal. Now, there's an elevation of that. And in fact, athletes will call themselves nerds. And I would look at it, I would go, really? And nobody makes anything of it. And so this is where I think this was starting to happen with Gen X. And so when they're writing the essay, notice it's a collective essay. It's a collective essay. Because now, and we'll see in a moment, Gen X is defining family differently because the typical family has let them down. And so they define family. In fact, this show, the beginning of the show, will tell you how they define family.
Thank you.
and you'll see this with even TV shows. You look at Seinfeld, you look at others, they define family different. And so what has happened? Since my family let me down, who can I count on? My friends. So let's look at these. Look at these notes with me for a moment here as we're working through this. We have Howe and Strauss, these guys that put together this book on generations. They call them the 13th generation. And what that means is it's the 13th generation since the United States started, okay, or since American history came to pass. And so even then, the Gen Xers couldn't win. 13. They're unlucky, all right? You know, some buildings don't even have a 13th floor. That's how superstitious they are. And so this generation comes along. They're also called busters. And I want you to notice why. It actually is in the first paragraph. The 13th, or the Gen X, is the most aborted generation in American history. After rising sharply during the late 1960s and early 1970s, the abortion rate climbed by another 80% during the first 6 years. So once Roe versus Wade happens in 73, through the birth years of last wave 13ers or Gen Xers, would-be mothers aborted one fetus in three. So think about the ramifications for a young person growing up in that and the talk of that. I don't know if you remember the discussion that you discussed it in school, but I remember I'm in high school, so I graduated in 79, okay? And I'm in high school, and this guy, this Catholic young man, was talking to me about abortion. And they were talking about kids born, could potentially be born with a heart. And they're saying all of these things. I don't know if you've ever heard that question about Beethoven, where they have all these facts about him, but you don't know they're talking about Beethoven. They say, this mom's going to give birth to like her ninth kid. There's a bunch of the kids before it have these birth defects, all these different things. They list all this stuff. They go, what should we do? And in my logical, now I go to church. What should we do? I'm thinking, abort. Now you know, because I'm telling you, the church didn't even preach against it. Catholics were actually the best concerning pro-life back then. The evangelical church avoided talking about it. And so I say, well, just abort it. And then they go, oh, by the way, you just killed Beethoven. And I was like, and it really caused me that. You would think that in church would be the place. It's my Catholic friend in school that challenged me to think differently concerning this. And I don't know where all of you, if you all, you know, stood right throughout, you know, your whole life and stuff like that, but I'm kind of showing you my cards. Okay? So this is what I grew up in. It was just a normal thing. People talked about it. It was just like, this is what happened. And so you hear that constantly. And it becomes a reality. And so millennials come along. Now, I'm talking millennials outside the church. It's just part of the DNA. It's talked about all the time. And so when it's talked about, you do it as if it's just a medical procedure. That's what they've grown up in. Let's keep going here. Parental divorce has struck Gen Xers harder than any other American generation. In 1962, half of all adult women believed that parents in bad marriages should stay together for the sake of the children. By 1980, only one in five thought so. So you see the divorce culture, what's happening there. 4/5 of today's divorced adults profess to be happier afterward, but a majority of their children feel otherwise. So there's abortion going on. There's more divorces going on. Look at the family complexity. No other generation, well, look at that. No other generation has ever grown up in families of such complexity. In 1980, just 56% of all dependent children lived with two once married parents. Another 14% with at least one previously married parent. 11% with a step parent. And 19% with one parent. One in five had half siblings. The likelihood of children receiving support payments from the non-custodial parent declined from the boomer to the 13er childhood eras. And so I'm growing up I would be on the late scale of boomer, early scale of Gen X, but I am really exposed to Gen X thinking. And so we moved from Chicago to the suburbs. And I've got a bunch of rich friends, okay? Okay, I'm not rich, but I've got a bunch of rich friends. It's very evident by my fashion choices. Okay, I was made very much aware of it, what I wore and things along that line. And you're living with us, and so I would go over to my friends' houses. I don't remember one of my friends having a mom home when I went over to their house. Free reign. Notes would be left saying, when you get home, fix this. When you get home, help your little brother with their homework. This is the stuff that's handed to Gen Xers on a regular basis. I don't know if the Gen Xers could relate to this or if we've got so much churchiness in our, and I'm not being that in a bad way, we're blessed to have church in our history. But if that was, you know, was that your life, Tori? Okay. Yeah. And so a boomer would look at that completely different. A Gen Xer comes along, and a lot of times Gen Xers get ripped on. They're actually a very self-sufficient generation. They had to be. They had many of their latchkey right off the bat. And so you can see the shift. And so why would friends be a show that they resonate with? Well, mom and dad weren't there. Mom and dad did this. Abortion, you know what I'm saying? So it's that negativity they're hearing, and they're responding in such a way. Look at this mother dissatisfaction. No other, next, last paragraph of the first page. No other child generation has witnessed such a dramatic increase in domestic dissatisfaction and surge to the workplace on the part of mothers. Between 1960 and 1980, among mothers with children aged 5 or under, the proportion of full or part-time jobs rose from 20 to 47%, look at that percentage. Through the 1970s, the number of latchkey children under age 14 left alone after school roughly doubled. You see the ramifications for that? You see how people start to view school? School, many times, becomes looked at as childcare, and that's gone into now. If you have a snow day, and school is off, and both parents work, the scramble that goes on to have to cover bases, that wouldn't have happened in earlier generations. Look at the child's viewpoint, top paragraph. A late 1980s survey of teen trend centers found 48% describing their mostly silent parents as cool. Well, you think, boy, the parent would like to be told this, versus just 7% as strict and 1% as nosy. So now, and it may be a part of guilt, I'm not with my kids enough, so what I'm going to do is, I'm going to become a cool parent. And that will be my goal. Has it helped us, by the way? Being a cool parent, has that helped us? Okay, I would love for my kids to think I'm pretty cool, but there is a part of me, who am I kidding? I'm only so cool, alright? When they first reached high school, 13-year-olds encountered much less of the teacher and voter indulgence that had greeted their next elders. The boom era grade inflation came to an abrupt end. Youth born in 1961, that's me, received 10% fewer high school A's and 10% more C's than those born in 1960. At the ballot box, first wave 13-year-olds were the target of the late 1970s Proposition 13 school tax revolts in California and other states. Okay, so the ramifications for schooling and propositions and how they go about doing things, child poverty benefits. It was my era that they started to see things where it wasn't just lunch. Now they're thinking about Head Start. They're thinking about breakfast in schools. Why? Because the family is looked at as different. Next paragraph. A sampling of teachers who taught boomers in the mid-1960s and 13-years in the mid-1980s was asked to compare the two. Have you ever had that where you had an old teacher, and you start talking about how things have changed? Like students, what were students like when you, they did this, what are they like now? You'll hear these things. And you're like, well, you have been teaching the same stuff. I mean, obviously curriculum changes, but how kids are responding to things. Boomer asked to compare the two in 43 measures of aptitude achievement. The score, boomers 38, 13ers 4, with one tie. The teachers scored Boomers higher in all academic skills, communications, ability, and commitment to learning. 13ers outscored Boomers in negotiating skills. Does that sound right? Okay. Consumer awareness, adult interaction skills. Have you ever seen so many people not afraid to go to the principal's office? As a sub, I go in, it's like people walk in the office like they own it. We avoided the principal's office. We were terrified of it. Amazing. I like it, but there's a part of me, there's a healthy fear. I feared Mrs. Wells. When she would walk the hall, she'd go, "Here, here." I'd go, "Oh, I'm out of there." She terrified me. And I knew I could run faster than her. But I think she could have killed me. 13, look at college education. The 13th is on its way to becoming the first generation since the Gilded, and that's in the 1820s, to be less college educated than its next elders. College completion rate 7 years after high school graduation fell from 58% for the Boomer class of 1972 to 37% for the 13-year class of 1980. Meanwhile, the economic stakes of higher education have risen sharply. And if, you know, talking about dropouts and all that stuff. Look at this, look at military. Remember Boomers, how they were reacting to the military? There's a negativity toward it. Look at this. By a 2-to-1 majority, 13er men prefer military to civilian public service. Isn't it interesting how the pendulum swings? In a sharp turnaround from the boom youth era, starting with the first 13er cohort reached age 19, the armed forces began a dramatic 3-year rise in the quality of new enlistees. There now is a new patriotism coming into play, isn't it? And I'm glad. That bothers me what happened to Vietnam vets when they came home. 13ers are the best generation of soldiers in America, best educated generation of soldiers in American history. Now look at this. Much like Michael J. Fox, now you know him in Family Ties? You ever see him? I think it's Alex Keaton is his character, the conservative kid of liberal parents. I mean, that was a picture of Gen Xers and the response to boomers. These are by far the most Republican-leaning youth in the 60-year history of age-based polling. From boom to 13th, the partisan tone of young voters has shifted strikingly from roughly to a 10% Democratic advantage to a Republican edge that in 1985 reached 18 points. 13ers gave Ronald Reagan a higher approval rating than any other generation except the lost. Okay? And so we see in the 80s we've got yuppies. You know what yuppies stood for? Young urban professional. Okay? Get rid of dinks. Dinks was coming out. Double income, no kids. Yeah. And so you hear all these acrostics concerning trying to make sense of what was going on. Look at how they knew death, or what was going on with death. 13-year teenagers faced a much lower risk of dying from disease than did silent teenagers 40 years ago. So we're like, well, this is great, we got medical advances, look what happened. But this 13-year advantage has been almost entirely offset by a much higher risk of dying from accidents, murder, and suicide. Isn't that sobering? Roughly 2,000 minors were murdered in 1988, twice the number killed in 1965. What about fear? Next paragraph. Fear is a pervasive reality within a generation of urban school children that brings an estimated 135,000 guns and 6 times as many knives to the classroom each day. 8% of urban 7th to 12th graders say they miss at least one day of school per month because they are physically afraid to go. At the same time, 13ers learn young that the only way to cope with fear is not show it. Suicide, as teen person, next paragraph, as teenagers, 13ers are committing suicide more frequently than any generation since the lost. In 1976, the child suicide rate rose above the previous record set in 1908. Through the 1980s, roughly 5,000 children under age 18 committed suicide each year, the largest number of proportion ever recorded for that age bracket. And so you just, is this, now as we're going to be moving into millennials soon here, are certain things making sense to you as you see generations, even the response? I don't know if you noticed, but yes, Donald Trump won this past election. But I have never seen so many looking like 60s age kids the response to Bernie Sanders? That's shocking. No, it's shocking to me. But what it is it's the pendulum swinging. Okay? They look at it, they look at their parents who grew up in the 80s, there's all this success, and all of a sudden the market crashes and all these things, and they're like, what's going to work? Maybe if we brought in socialism, maybe that would work. Because, well, and families completely defined differently with millennials. Completely. I'll have discussions and they'll look at me like I'm talking Chinese. And so that's what I was hoping as we've been working through this month, to have an understanding that so much of this is the pendulum swinging back and forth. People trying to make sense of life apart from God. And so, and you can keep looking at these on your own, how they view prison, how they view economics, home ownership, what that looks like, the fiscal burden. But I'd like you to think with me about church for all. We'll make a shift here in a moment here. But how people view church. There was a thing that started to come into being. Remember we talked about Jesus people last week and people responding? People start leaving church or not showing up in droves. And so what starts to happen is this. It's kind of like what I was talking to with you at the beginning. There were people saying, you know what? We got to get people back to church. And so what we're going to do is we're going to create church for people who don't like church. And so what they did is they licked their finger, figuratively speaking, and they looked at what was going on with the culture, and they go, what we need to create a church that is, we call it seeker sensitive. And I don't believe biblically that that's accurate anyways, because the Bible says in Romans chapter 3 that no one seeks after God. Okay? But if you create it in such a way that people are like, it's so nice you've got a Starbucks in your lobby. That's so nice that you, every month you're going to preach on my felt needs. And churches do this, and it isn't necessarily bad as long as they stick with Scripture. But I can't keep going around going, are you happy? Are you happy? Are you happy? I was just talking to Greg Schaefer at Daphne's house the other day, and we're talking, and he's frustrated because he's a Gen Xer, okay? But he's watching the next generation. Huh? He's millennial, yeah, he's millennial. But he's frustrated because what's happening is with bosses that are dealing with workers, I mean, some of the stuff that's going on with some of you that have to do leadership, and how they're not showing up for work. They want this and they want that. And he said that some of the bosses that he's talking to, he's saying, what can we do to get these people to come to work? And you know what? And Greg looks at me and goes, we pay them. We already pay them. What more do you? But it's like, we've got to send a text to remind. We have to say this. We've got all, what are the perks? Well, all these different things. And so older generation look at that and they go, and what's frustrating sometimes with me as a pastor is that I'm starting to think like that. What do we do? What do I need to text everybody? We've got reminders. And it's funny that what you start to slip into is you're not careful. It's nice to get a reminder. But no offense, I shouldn't have to beg you to go to church. I shouldn't, you know what I'm saying? It's encouraged and things along that line. And so what happens is Greg was completely frustrated. It's just so funny because I'm looking at him and going, okay, that's cool. That's cool that that is going on. And I'm praying, here's what I'm praying out of it, that the pendulum swings so much so that people get sick of that and they move back. And so we have when it comes to this, this seeker perspective, other churches would come up and they would do these things. There was a guy named Bill Hyatt, some of you have ever heard of him. He started a church called Willow Creek Community Church. And it is hardcore seeker sensitive. Big time seeker sensitive. What's interesting is, what he started to see, what was coming out of the product was, he didn't like what he was seeing that was coming out of the church. And so he said, we've got to get back to the basics again. The problem was, after he had that meeting and they talked about making those mistakes, they started over again what they were doing in the first place. What can we do to appeal to this generation instead of going, let's get back to the Word? That's what frustrated me as I watched it. Other things, I want to show you some other things that were going on at church, and then in a moment we'll open up for some questions. Here's another thing that Gen Xers were seeing when they were viewing the church, and this is how they view church. He had committed adultery, or he had been found with prostitutes.
God said to David,
looking to his wife just then. He's a televangelist.
3,000 years ago, you have done this thing in secret, but I will do what I do openly before all of Israel. My sin was done in secret. And God has said to me, I will do what I do before the whole world. Blessed be the name of the Lord.
And so Gen Xers would turn on their TV. They see Nightline, him being interviewed early on, and him being, you know, he's sitting there and he's answering all these questions, and then this comes out. And by the way, I love this guy. I want you to know I love this guy. He's ministered to my heart. He did something very, very wrong, okay? But even since then, I think he took proper steps and things along that line. But a Gen Xer goes, oh, typical, this is what's going on. And so they start to react to that. They start to equate that. The culture starts to equate that with Christians. Him, Jim Baker, others, this was going on. While this was also going on, we saw a pop culture thing that started to become very, very popular. And so DC Talk, I don't know if you guys have ever heard of DC Talk. They're out of Washington, D.C., but they ended up calling themselves DC Talk, and they said it stood for Decent Christian Talk. Okay, and they were Christian rappers, and here they are on Arsenio Hall. Okay, so what starts to happen is Christian music starts to become mainstream. This is DC Talk on Arsenio Hall. Not appropriate.
You can sing it
faster. Yo, yo, yo.
With the mighty clouds of joy, this is DC Talk.
And that's Toby Mack and Michael Tate. But what was starting to happen for us as Christians is if I heard that, like I was talking about Jarvis and Clay, they were going to be on Letterman, and I knew that they were going to be on Letterman, I tried to watch Letterman that night. If Sixth Sense None the Richer was going to be on Letterman, I'd watch that. If I knew that on Arsenio Hall, DC Talk was going to be on that, when you get news of it, you were just so excited because here's what it was. We're cool too. I want you to know. I'm a Christian, but I'm cool. No, what I like, you'd really like it if you guys would listen to it. It'd be really, really cool. That's so foreign to the church as it was. That wasn't an issue. That wasn't. I know everybody always wanted to be cool, but now we're starting to be mainstream. And this is what's going on. I want to open it up for your questions or comments or thoughts right now.